My guest today on Piano Jazz is guitarist arranger Pat Metheny. He's a musician without peer. His style of playing, harmonic concept, and original ideas are totally his own. Throughout his career, Pat continues to evolve as he works with new technology and improvisation skills. He's certainly one of the brightest stars in the jazz firmament. And I say so. And so does everybody else. How are you, Pat?
I'm great, and I'm so glad to be here with you today, Marian.
Oh, I'm just so glad to have you. And when I think of when I first met you, you were only about 15, 16.
Yeah. I think I was actually 14 when I met you for the first time. Yeah,
in Decatur, Illinois.
And that's right.
We were doing the sort of guest faculty, and I can't believe it, you were a student.
Well, you were incredibly inspiring, actually. And, you know, it was a very big week for me. It was one of the first times I'd ever left home, you know.
Really?
In fact, I think it was the first time I was ever away from my parents, you know.
And, really? I didn't know that.
I had won, like, a little scholarship from Downbeat magazine, which was a shock. I mean, it was something that I hadn't anticipated at all. I had entered this contest by sort of playing basically an exact copy of a Wes Montgomery solo, and the prize was to go to this camp, and you were there, and I had several master classes with you and met a few musicians that I've stayed in touch with to this day. But I mean, it was the first time I'd ever really been around other kids my age that had an interest and an awareness of jazz on a high level, and it was a very important week for me. And I think I even wrote a tune that
you did. You wrote it was a big band piece, actually, and it was called Charge.
And there's a funny reason why it was called Charge.
Yeah, why was it?
Because my dad had a business in the little town I'm from, Lee Summit, and I noticed that professional arrangers always had like a rubber stamp at the top of the chart that had the name of the chart on it.
Right.
And the only rubber stamp my dad had was Charged. So
oh.
I used that rubber stamp, and therefore the tune was called Charged.
So I think that was put great.
I was really country then, you know. I
mean, well, it was great to have that piece, and I've got to unearth that thing and bloody well play it.
Well, I mean, it wasn't the most advanced composition in the world, but it was a thrill to be able to write something, and I appreciated very much that you enjoyed it and that you supported it and approved of it and everything.
Well, that whole week, or whether it was a week or 2 weeks, I don't know what it was, but it was very enjoyable, and the kids were all very good, especially yourself. And now it just seems like a minute, but it's I don't know how many years. And
well, that would have
here
been 19.
You are today, as yeah. I say, a big star in jazz, and you brought your group with you. Who did you bring?
Well, I'm just so happy to have had the opportunity over the last 10 or 15 years to have played often with one of the great bass players of our time, and I just can't say enough about him. But it's not just me, it's everybody that knows him and that loves him, as we all do, and that's the great Christian McBride on the bass.
That imp.
And joining us on the drums is a guy who's also been a member of my regular group, the Pat Metheny Group, for the past few years. And to me, he's one of the most exciting drummers to show up in many, many years. He's from Mexico, and his name is Antonio Sanchez.
Well, it's just great to have all of you here. And I'm dying to hear you play something. So what do you think the first number is likely to be?
Well, I thought we'd start from the very beginning, which is the first tune on the first album that I ever made many years ago, and it's still fun to play, especially with Christian and Antonio, and it's called Bright Size Life.
Wonderful. Can't wait to hear it.
Thank you.
Boy, that kills me that that's the first tune you wrote ever. And I mean, it sounds as if you just wrote it today or yesterday. It's a really wonderful tune.
Well, thank you.
That was what you started out with when you were, what, about 17 or something?
Yeah,
17 like that.
Or 18. I mean, for me, the whole thing of writing music sort of evolved as a platform for... It was out of necessity, actually, because there was a way I wanted to play as an improviser that I was having a hard time sort of reconciling with playing on standards and playing on blues forms and the kinds of things that I was doing, you know, around Kansas City with the musicians I was playing with there.
You didn't want to do those particularly.
Well, I did, actually, and I loved it, and I still do. I still love playing, you know, in that way. But there was a certain kind of thing that... I felt like I needed to come up with an environment to support this way of improvising. And that tune is kind of still remains a good example. I mean, you know, the kind of harmonic things that are going on are more like just simple triads and very almost folk-like kinds of harmonic motions.
Yeah.
And to me, that was a very appealing and a very resonant area of interest to express what I was doing as an improviser.
You really knew just what you wanted to do right then. And then when did Gary Burton get into your life? Just around
time? Yeah, I was a big fan of his group from that period in the late 60s. Especially, they were one of the bands that I felt was really trying to kind of find a place within the jazz language that had that kind of resonance with the times of what was happening there. And of course, you know, everybody talks about Bitches Brew and Miles Davis and all that stuff, which of course was also important. But Gary's band maybe is a little bit forgotten in that story of what was happening in that same period of time.
It's amazing to think of that anything he does could be forgotten.
Maybe not forgotten, but maybe not quite as appreciated historically as having the impact that I think it did have.
No, that's true, and it's good that you brought that up, because he's so wonderful, and I imagine that he was very helpful to you at that time,
wasn't
he?
Well, getting to join his band at the age of 18 was sort of like joining the Beatles for me. I mean, that was my favorite band, and you know, the fact that I... you know, might get to play with them ever in my entire life was sort of a major goal, and to be able to do it so young was great in itself. But the best part was being around not only Gary, but Steve Swallow and Bob Moses and Mick Goodrick, the other guys
who
were in the band.
God,
then.
When I think of Steve Swallow, he worked with me too a great deal. What a funny guy, from being a wonderful player.
He is one of the great people on earth, no
yes,
question
Yes,
he
certainly
it.
Is. Yeah. God, well, that must have been a great time for you with all these thoughts going through your head and all the music that you have inside you that you want to get some of it out.
Well, I was very kind of determined in a way to follow what I saw as kind of an essential component throughout jazz history, which was musicians who found a way to manifest into sound the things that they found to be true and to be real to them. And, you know, in my case, my story was a little bit different. I came from a country town out in the middle of Missouri, and it was not the same as growing up in Philly like Christian or, you know, doing, you know, all the different other avenues that people have found their way into jazz, like you too. I mean, you know, I came from a different angle. And to me, I always embraced that. I never tried to hide from that. And to me, jazz is a form that not only accepts other things, it kind of demands that kind of honesty, that kind of personal connection to what you play.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, you cannot play jazz and not be an honest person. You can't be a fake jazz player.
Yeah. So, and I think that,
sure.
You know, along with that, there's a tendency to emulate people that are your favorites. And my favorite was Wes Montgomery. He was my hero. But even at a very early age, I was around musicians who kind of took a dim view of that. Whenever I'd whip out my Wes Montgomery thing, you know, people would kind of, you know, look at me kind of funny. They, you know, the audience would always love it.
Doing something that he did.
Right. And it was really a stroke of luck for me to be around musicians who kind of didn't really see that as necessarily a good thing, that I could get a lot of audience response by imitating another musician. And that encouraged me very early on to kind of try to investigate things.
Yeah, but also, I mean, you were imitating him, but now, years later, you've done your own research and you've got your own thing going.
Well, research is a word I like. I mean, you know, whenever somebody gives us a gig or you get to make one more record, I just consider it exactly that. It's like another point of research into the goal of trying to understand music in a deep way and become a good player.
Go on forever doing that, yeah. Which reminds me, I would love to hear another tune.
Well, we're going to do one now that we've been doing in the trio setting that it was originally done with my regular bigger band, and this is called So May It Secretly Begin, and it'll have an introduction on a kind of unique special guitar.
What a title.
It's a painting by Paul Klee, the great painter, the great yes. Swiss painter. So May It Secretly Begin, yeah.
Okay.
All right.
How do you choose? I mean, once in a while you play a standard tune, do you?
Yeah, I
once
do. Once in a while. And in love doing it. And I mean, I'd be actually quite happy doing nothing but that. And it really takes a certain amount of kind of willpower and discipline not to do just that, I think.
Because really?
I think that once you get to the point that you've kind of got a way of addressing that material, it's so fun to do, and it's, you know, there's so much, I mean, there's the infinity of all the good songs that have ever been written to draw from.
That's true, and there are so many.
And at some point, actually, I think I probably will take a year or two and just play all other people's music. I mean,
really?
It's something that I love doing. And
well, anything you do is going to sound great, but I mean, that would be a nice thing to do, just for people to hear how you approach their music.
Well, you know, I feel like the whole thing of kind of coming up with an environment for improvising that also is, you know, sort of built into the compositions, that also takes advantage of who the players are and what their strengths are, kind of all add up to what it is to be a band leader for me personally. And you know, there's infinite challenges always in that question of what are we going to play and how are we going to play it. You
know, that in itself is a big thing, to be a band leader.
I see so many examples of people that just take it a little bit more casually than I do, in the sense that they'll, you know, play kind of whatever. And actually, there's some real pluses to that, because I think it does add to a certain kind of day-to-day fun, you know, by just kind of playing anything each night.
Yeah.
For me, it's I really think of each night kind of as one tune. It's sort of like that band playing in that room on that occasion with that audience. To me, I when it's at its best, I see that as one long song. And
no,
I kind of try to think of it like that.
That's true. That's a very good way to think of it, too. And it's like your whole persona and the music and everything are one for that, just for that one night. And then the whole thing was like on to the next night.
Well, that's part of the fun of it too, is just how wildly different it is from night to night.
Yes.
I mean, even if you're playing the same place
night
after night, each night has a completely different feeling.
That's true. Well, we've got an Ornette Coleman tune. I'm excited because his is sort of a dangerous kind of music.
Well, so they say. I mean, you know, honestly, for me, I sort of got familiar with Ornette's records without knowing that it was supposed to be anything other than a whole lot of fun. I didn't read the articles that talked about all the fights that broke out and all the arguments and all the this, that, or the other thing. When I heard Ornette's music for the first time, I was probably about 11 or 12 years old. And the first impression that I had was that it sounded like everybody that was playing was really happy.
That's true.
And it sounded like, and still sounds to me, like really happy music. And I think Ornette is, in fact, having now had the incredible fortune of getting to know him a little bit over the years, one of the most genuinely good people ever. I mean,
I'm
he's
sure
just such a
right.
good-hearted guy.
Yes.
And I think that really comes out in his music.
I think the first piece I ever heard was Ramblin', and that to me is sort of like a down-home. It's almost like, to me, like walking through a farm or something, and just very easygoing and really a fun thing. And I don't know as many of his tunes as I should, because if they're all like that, then they must all be fun.
Well, this particular one comes from a collaboration that we did together exactly 20 years ago, right around now.
And that you did with Ornette?
Yeah, it's called Song X.
Wonderful.
And it all happened very quickly then, as jazz records do, where we recorded in a couple days, we mixed the next day, we mastered it the next day, and that was that. And with its 20-year anniversary, I was able to go back, and I found six tunes that were on the original that we weren't able to put on the original, because back then, of course, it was vinyl. There weren't CDs yet, so you had a limited amount of time you could play with.
Right.
And this is one of the tunes that was not on the original, but is on the reissued version of Song
X. I love the title, Police People.
He's great at titles, too.
Lends itself to all kinds of imaginary things. Can't wait to hear it. You and the group, you and your other police people.
Well, here it is.
Can't wait. Hear the full Piano Jazz broadcast. Tune in next week to your NPR station. Log on to pianojazz.org to find a station in your area. Piano Jazz is a production of South Carolina ETV and Radio. Support for Piano Jazz comes from the National Endowment for the Arts, Baldwin Piano Company, the Friends of Piano Jazz, and NPR.